It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast, brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope that you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one and share it with a friend if you find it of interest. Today, my guest is Josh Krauschauer. He is the senior political correspondent for Axios and a Fox News contributor. He's someone who obviously pays a ton of attention to what's going on in terms of the election scene across the country, and he's paying very close attention to what's going on within these midterms. We talk about the House, the Senate, governor's races, and who some of the potential Democrats might be who could pick up the pieces after what might be a midterm that leaves a lot of wreckage for their party. Josh Krauschauer coming up right after this.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
Josh Krauschauer, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Hey, Ben, it's great to be back on the podcast.
So obviously we have to spend our time today talking about the biggest news that is dominating everybody's mind at the moment, which is what's going to happen with Donda Academy shutting down and then reopening immediately again. No, I, of course, am happy to talk to you about the upcoming midterms and everything that we're seeing going on there. I know that you've been following this very closely, and I've been reading your work at Axios. And one of the things that I wanted to start off by asking you about is this narrative that seems to have formed in the last couple of weeks, that what we're seeing here is a bunch of races across the board tightening. From your own perspective, do you think that that's really what's going on? Or have these races always been kind of closer than we necessarily could assess, given the various registered voter polls and other data that we had to work with, given the fundamentals at play regarding the economy and the level of President Biden's popularity?
So, Ben, as you know, I'm not a huge fan of the analysts who just average polls, and that's the extent of political analysis. I think the more reporting you do, the more understanding of history you know, you get a much, much more textured understanding of political elections and how to look at midterm races and midterm environments. And, you know, look, I've said this for a while, but the fundamentals were always going to be rough for the party in power. They're always going to be challenging for the Democratic Party. And even more so because we've seen where this economy is, how volatile it is at best, and the fact that we might be heading into a pretty tough recession in the next year. That's not good if you're the party in power. You're in charge. You're responsible for the economy and everything that's going on. And all you got to do is look at even the best polls for President Biden have his numbers at best in the mid-40s. That's almost every year, if you're president in the first midterm, whose numbers are underwater like that, you're going to get a shellacking in the midterm election. That's just history, fundamentals, politics 101. Now, look, I think the overturning of Roe v. Wade certainly energized Democrats at a level that they weren't engaged at for much of the year earlier in the spring. And that was always going to be a factor in the whole midterm picture. But you also have to understand that, like, a lot of people don't follow politics like you and I do. They don't even know who their congressman is in some cases, right? Or they do when they follow.
They live more balanced lives. Let's just be honest.
They're normal. Yeah, they're normal. Normal people. And they may do some research or, like, look into things the week or two before they have to vote. And, you know, you see this a lot where there are a lot of undecided, or there are enough undecideds. Those undecideds are people that are not political junkies. They tend to break against, like, if things are going well, they'll vote for the party in power. If things are not going well, they'll vote against the party in power. And, you know, like clockwork, you're seeing a lot of these undecideds in key races breaking towards the Republicans because, just again, the fundamentals and just the economy is not in good shape. And crime, by the way, is a huge, huge issue in a bunch of states. And that is Yeah, right track, wrong track. About 70% of Americans, including a whole lot of Democrats, think that country's headed in the wrong direction. That is not a good sign for anyone trying to win over these undecided voters.
So I want to ask what may seem like an odd question, just because I don't really understand the decision process that has gone on the Democratic side of the ledger. And let me take a step back. I talk to a lot of Republican consultants, and I talk to a lot of people who do kind of, who are in kind of the middle. They do Democrat or Republican sort of adjacent polling, or they do a lot of corporate consulting, which tends to these days put them more on the Democratic side of the ledger. And talking to those people, you know, a lot of the things that I heard were basically, you know, people sort of surprised that Democrats hadn't come up with better messaging on the economy, on the border, on crime over the past couple of months. They were legitimately surprised that there wasn't a sort of assertive campaign on the part of these Democrats to hedge things off. But do you feel like there was no attempt made on that front? Do you feel like it was there were attempts made, but that they failed? Or was this a situation where these issues, which have really been the dominant issues with the exception of the kind of moment immediately after Dobbs, pretty consistently over the past several months?
So, you know, I don't think they had a good hand to play with. I mean, I really think that there were limitations given how things are in the country right now, especially when it comes to the economy. I mean, if you voted for the $1.9 trillion in stimulus, which almost every Democrat did, that's on your record. That's mm-hmm. tough to message. It's challenging for anyone dealing with a bad economy, and you're the incumbent to message that argument. Now, I think the mistake that was made, in hindsight, is that Democrats got so convinced that abortion was going to be almost as big of an issue as the economy. And if you looked at the advertising in a bunch of these big races, there wasn't a lot of these senators and House incumbents for the Democrats did not talk about the economy at all. In fact, I wrote about in Axios in New Hampshire, which, you know, Maggie Hassan looks like she's slightly favored. But she just did her first ad about the Inflation Reduction Act just last week. Didn't talk about it in her ads right away. And that may be a mistake. That may be a problem because that inflation is the top issue for voters. And if you're just a one-trick pony, if you're just saying the same thing about an issue that is a secondary concern for voters, they may be pro-choice. They may be sympathetic to where these Democrats are on that issue. But if you're just talking about abortion to the exclusion of everything else, that is a challenge that they faced. Mm-hmm. I also would add that the one area where Democrats could be doing a much better job on is crime. And, you know, I think they made some mistakes nominating candidates that are well to the left of where your average voter is on how to deal with the rising crime and how to deal with policing and so on. I mean, Mandela Barnes, Fetterman, those are the two, I think, leading examples where you had other alternatives that were more moderate, and the Democrats did not get involved. They didn't engage in the primaries. And now you're dealing with, in the case of Fetterman, you're dealing with the health issues as well. But there are candidates, Oregon's another good example, where you have in the governor's race and in a lot of House races, Democrats that said they wanted to defund the police or have supported drug legalization measures that are just really unpopular now. And, you know, if they had to do it over again, I would think that they would probably want to change their positions on some of these hot button issues.
So let's drill down to a couple of the specific races and things that we'll be paying attention to, you and I, on election night. You know, first off, on the House side, what are some of the key races from your perspective that you'll be paying attention to? And how early do you think potentially we'll be able to know that the House is going to change hands?
I think we'll know pretty early where this is headed. My home state of Virginia is going to probably be one of the first states to report results, mm-hmm. if history is any guide. And Abigail Spanberger's race in my neck of the woods in Northern Virginia, Prince William County, that's a Biden, I believe, +8 district. And it was a race that a lot of Democrats thought they actually had in the bag or close to it. And now there's a lot more nervousness about that race. She's running against a Hispanic law enforcement officer in Yesley Vega. who is, you know, she made a comment about abortion that's been aired all over all over TV, portraying her as an extremist on the abortion issue. But this is the, just to the point we're talking about. If that abortion issue doesn't really hit as much as Democrats want it to, you'll know early on, because that'll be a signal that if Spanberger does not win in that Virginia district. You know, one of my favorite races, Ben, is the Pennsylvania 8th district. It's it's Matt Cartwright, the congressman who's in a Trump, one of the few Democrats in a Trump district. It's Joe Biden's hometown. Scranton is in that district. And it's the place where Donald Trump did his first general election rally for Dr. Oz and the rest of the Republican ticket. And it's a swing district, and it has a lot of relevance in the larger political picture. So that's a race we probably will get some early results in. And if Cartwright loses after winning in 2020 in a Trump district, that will also be a pretty powerful sign of where the political mood is in the country.
The tension obviously has been in the last several weeks more focused on the Senate side, because I think, you know, any Democrat who doesn't actually receive a check from some Democrat entity will tell you that they expect to lose the House. The difference on the Senate side has been, you know, really for the last several months now, an overall critique of the candidates that were selected at the behest of former President Trump, but also, you know, obviously at the behest of the voters in these states who, you know, came out and supported a bunch of outsiders. Obviously, that includes, you know, Dr. Oz, it includes Herschel Walker, it includes J.D. Vance and Blake Masters. And those are all people who, you know, have never run, you know, for office or held office before. And obviously, you know, there's also on kind of the edge sense of this, you also have similar situations in bluer states that are less likely to turn over. But still, you have essentially a slate that includes a far higher representation of outsider candidates who, many of them, after their primaries, struggled to raise money to be able to have the resources that they would need to carry them over the finish line. When you look at this slate right now, who do you believe stands in the weakest position out of this Republican field? I think, you know, all these different states that people have become pretty familiar with. And who do you think stands at the strongest position?
That's a great question. I'll take one step back, and then I'll go into the answer. When people ask me, like, how do you define what a wave is? Like, my first response is a wave sweeps through even candidates that aren't ready for political primetime. Mm-hmm. So these candidates, there are a lot of folks that qualify in that Senate lineup of Republican recruits. Don Baldock, I would put Don Baldock as the answer to your first question.
Like, yes.
Who would be the weakest in the weakest position to take advantage of where things are? But the fact that he's still in the race, Ben, is a sign that this is a pretty sizable wave that seems to be building a couple weeks out. So Baldock just didn't raise a whole lot of money. He wasn't backed by the party. McConnell, I broke some news at Axios last week that the millions and millions of dollars that Republicans had been spending in the super PAC for Don Baldock, they withdrew, even though the polls showed it pretty competitive. So he's getting outspent. He's getting outworked, or maybe he's not getting outworked because he's doing a lot of campaign events, but he's getting outspent, and his positions and his comments have made him a little bit not ready for prime time. But look, I can see New Hampshire, and New Hampshire's a very wavy state where if people want to vote Republican, they'll vote straight ticket Republican, and that could sweep him across the finish line. I don't think it's 50-50, but, you know, there's a chance that could happen. Arizona would be the other state where, you know, look, I think it's pretty clear that someone like Blake Masters is underperforming, because if the Governor Ducey was running in this type of political environment, he'd probably be up by a few points, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe even more. And the fact that Arizona is still, and it's a toss up, and the Cook Political Report this week moved it from a lean Dem seat to a toss up. But that's a lot of, most of the reason is it's the national environment and the statewide environment turning much more favorably towards the Republican Party. If Blake Masters isn't able to take advantage of that, that is a signal that his you know, brand of Republican politics isn't quite as sellable in a swing state like Arizona. But if he does, mm-hmm. again, you don't, in a wave year, you just see some candidates that may not be the best candidates, but they get swept in along with the red tide.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the sort of the strongest side of the equation, you know, it seems to me that, you know, there was a lot of assumptions that went into this cycle that said, you know, we've got kind of this slate of Gen X Democrats who have been perhaps frustrated by their experience in Congress, you know, decided to leave, became more national figures in the case of some of them. You see, you know, Beto obviously running for governor. You see Stacey Abrams running for governor. You see Tim Ryan running for Senate. You see Val Demings running for Senate. There are a number of people who are in that kind of category generationally who are no longer in the House, but seem all to be destined to go down pretty significantly when it comes to the outcome in the elections. Is this an indictment of the overall approach that Democrats have had in terms of promoting, you know, younger potential leaders? Because if you sweep away the leadership in Washington, thanks to this, you know, the likelihood of Republicans taking the House, you could really have a situation where AOC becomes the most well-known member of Congress.
It's fascinating, Ben, that I'm amazed that there's like a disconnect between sort of the image of Stacey Abrams, the image of Beto O'Rourke, and the political realities in running in those swing states or reddish states. Mm-hmm. I mean, Abrams was always someone, she ran in a wave year for Democrats and wasn't able to get across the finish line. Same with Beto, but though I think Beto's performance may be a little better because it was Texas, mm-hmm. but this was a year where almost every swing state, swing district Democrat won, and Abrams couldn't quite do it. Beto couldn't quite do it, right? And now they're facing political headwind, or they're facing problems where the party is not well liked, and they're doing much worse. And Abrams might lose by double digits, Ben, mm-hmm. to Governor Kemp. And look, I there are Democrats that are able to kind of adjust with the political tide. There's someone like a Josh Shapiro who's running, who I think is a legitimate political star to watch, mm-hmm. who's running in the governor's race in Pennsylvania, who's actually disagreeing with John Fetterman about his position on criminal justice.
Yes.
He's he supports school choice. I mean, it's really fascinating to see how he sees the political winds shifting. And then you have someone like Stacey Abrams, who, if anything, has gotten more liberal since the mm-hmm. 20. I mean, she's taken positions that are well to the left of where she was in 2018, very identity politics oriented. She was on Morning Joe last week talking about how abortion is an economic issue, which, again, very, very whatever you think about the substance, it's political in a state like Georgia. That is not the message you need to be selling in the final home stretch of a campaign. You know, Beto is sort of in the same position where, you know, he got the base juiced up, and he thinks that's the way to win an election. A lot of these Democrats think that you need to turn out the base more, and you don't have to appeal to moderate swing voters. And if anything we've learned in the last few years, like Joe Biden showed, you know, he might have been the only Democrat that could have won the 2020 election, and he didn't even learn his own lesson, right? He didn't even learn his own lesson after winning, because he pandered to the progressive wing of the party, and it gave him all sorts of political problems. So yeah, like if there's anything that a Republican win in Congress will send to the Democratic Party, it would be that, hey, you can't just juice the base and expect to win. You need to build a broad coalition. You need to appeal to the moderate voters on both sides.
What new face, you just mentioned Josh Shapiro, and I think you're right about him, is going to emerge in terms of either a statewide candidate for a governorship or for the Senate, who will become a more prominent figure or has the potential to do so on the Democratic side? I've heard some talk about Wes Moore, for instance, in Maryland. I've heard, you know, a couple of other names, you know, come up. Is there someone on their side who's going to emerge from this? Because, you know, even if they have, you know, a terrible year, they're still going to have a situation where, you know, there's going to be a demand for new leadership and new people to take on new roles within the coalition and push back against Republicans going forward.
So I'll give you two additional names. One, if Raphael Warnock wins If he's the one Democrat, and I think that's very possible, and it could go to a runoff. We could have another month of a, and he could, that might actually play to his benefit. He's going to be someone who is a budding star in the Democratic Party if he isn't already. Now, if he loses, you know, take that off the table, but he's got a chance to win. He's actually running very competitively still against Herschel Walker. His numbers, if you look at the favorability rating, quite good for a Democrat in Georgia. It's interesting. Stacey Abrams is one of the least popular Democrats in Georgia. Raphael Warnock is one of the more popular Democrats. And he's, you know, he's running a politically smart race, and he's praising his work with Tommy Tuberville and, you know, other conservative Ted Cruz. He's not calling them racists. He's actually doing the work, compromising work. And he, you know, I think he has a fairly liberal voting record, but he's also messaging to moderates in that Senate campaign. So, look, if he wins, and he has a very tough race ahead, but if he wins, I think you'll hear a lot more about Senator Warnock. I'd also mention Jared Polis, the Colorado governor, who I've written about before. You know, I don't know if he has national ambitions, but he's someone who's slated to win his reelection at a time when Democrats are losing many, many swing states and even bluer states than Colorado. And he's done it because he hasn't taken the progressive line on COVID. He's been a much more libertarian-minded Democrat when it comes to schools, COVID, a lot of the big hot-button issues of the last few years. And he'll be someone to watch. I don't know if he'll run for president, but he's someone to watch as a model for where the Democratic Party can go.
Hey, look, I think if the conversation shifts to should Joe run again, and I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I think that people are underestimating the likelihood that there's a name that emerges that has not been on the lips of sort of the typical DC consultant set about alternatives. But that would obviously be, that would take a lot. That's jumping ahead. So on the Republican side, let's assume for the sake of argument that they do end up taking, that the incumbents win. Let's say they take, some of these, situations where we expect them to perform, the outcomes are, you know, as we expected. So then you have Arizona, Nevada, Georgia. Taking two out of three of those is a pretty hard thing to do. When do you think we'll actually know if they did it or not, given that Georgia, as you said before, could go to a runoff? Nevada could be very close. Arizona obviously has taken forever to count in, you know, numerous times, most recently in their primary. Is this a situation where you think we're going to know the answer to the outcomes in two out of three of those races on election night? Or do you think we're going to have to wait?
For the Senate, we'll probably have to wait at least to get an official call. We may know where the tea leaves are, where things are headed. Arizona takes, you know, its time because they do the mail-in balloting, and there may be the issue of elections and election administration has kind of gone to a fever pitch in that state. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to take some time, but I do think the overall vibe will be known pretty early. If Republicans get an early House call, that's a sign of where the Senate's going to be headed. And look, I think they're two different. Like, I think even if you, it would take a really big wave, I think, to see a state like Arizona or New Hampshire flipping. But it doesn't take a huge wave to get to 51 for the Republicans. Like Pennsylvania and Nevada would do it, I think, assuming that no other surprises. So, you know, I think we'll get a good sense early enough where things are headed. But I don't think we'll get an official call until the next day, maybe the day after that.
The on the gubernatorial side, someone who I think a race that I believe deserves to have received more attention earlier and is getting it now that things have been apparently tightening, though there's you know, mixed evidence on that, is the Michigan gubernatorial race, which I think is very interesting for a lot of reasons. One, of course, being that Governor Whitmer became kind of a national hot button, just as Governor Newsom did, in terms of her COVID decisions. She also was someone who received serious consideration as potentially being vice president or the VP choice for Joe Biden if he had gone in a different direction than Kamala. And she's someone who has become, you know, pretty controversial in a lot of ways, but is also, you know, a major figure in a key swing state. The nominee there on the Republican side, Tudor Dixon, I think, you know, has a reputation as being a little on the edge, but in terms of the field that she was part of, she was actually kind of the least edgy, you know, candidate, I think it's fair to say, compared to some of the other folks who were running. And she obviously has the backing, sort of similar to Adam Laxalt in Nevada, getting like everybody on the same page. You know, she has the backing of like establishment Republicans, the DeVos family, and Donald Trump, which is, you know, a pretty rare thing, and perhaps sets you up for success. What do you think about that race? I don't know if you had the chance to watch their debate. And how do you think that, what do you think the potential is there for a flip?
So it's interesting. Michigan is one of those states where the polling has been off more than almost any other state in the country. And we're sort of seeing that. And I think Whitmer had like 10, 15 point leads in the polls a couple weeks ago. And now all of a sudden we're talking like margin of error in the latest polling. You know, look, the abortion issue is very big. And I mean, if there's one state where I think abortion may play to like a clear role in the Democratic Party success, it might be Michigan, because you have a referendum trying to certify certain protections for abortion, which is going to help turn out Democratic voters. You also have a I'm not talking about Tudor Dixon, but I'm talking about the nominees for AG and Secretary of State, who are from the very Trumpian wing of the party and have been sort of poster childs of sort of how the party has kind of gone too extreme. So I think those are going to be some challenges that Republicans have to overcome. Dixon also got into some trouble because in terms of specifying her position on abortion and should be regulated. So, you know, I think it's going to be close enough. I would give the advantage to Whitmer because of her money and her, you know, head start essentially. But Michigan's a swing state, Ben. It's a state that Trump won. And by the way, Obama, you know, who's going to Michigan? President. I'm having like some flashbacks to 2016. I remember I was stunned. You know, I thought Clinton was probably going to win in 2016, and I was stunned that she was making a last minute trip to Detroit the week before the election. I'm like, well, why would you go to Michigan when there's so many other battleground states? Turned out there were some real problems for Democrats in Michigan. Well, guess who's going to Michigan as one of his few stops on the campaign trail? Barack Obama. So that tells me, Ben, that there maybe Whitmer is favored, but they are not sold that she's out of the woods yet. And this is going to be a competitive race.
There's to sort of wrap things up, to me, there's a lot of open questions about the way this potential Republican majority behaves when it comes to the Senate. On the House side, I think it's going to be a little bit more predictable. You know, you can see the different ways that they're going to do oversight. I would expect them to pursue impeachment of Alexander Mayorkas because that's going to be something that satisfies the, you know, the conservative wing. You can kind of see what their behavior would be like. But with all these outsiders potentially coming to the Senate, let's just assume for the sake of argument that, you know, J.D. Vance wins, that Adam Laxalt wins, that, you know, you've got Ted Budd, you've got Mark Wayne Mullen, you've got Dr. Oz, and you've got Herschel. OK, let's say that Blake's the sort of coin in the air kind of thing where we don't know. That's a slate that includes, it's essentially half outsiders, you know, and at least in terms of their mindsets. And, you know, when it comes to the way that they're going to treat their job as a senator, that's going to be something that really, I think, could determine a lot of different things. We see how much of an impact, you know, just having one or two senators who have agreement on the way that the things ought to be approached can be a thorn in the side of Mitch McConnell and the typical Republican Senate leadership. What do you expect should Republicans have the kind of night that the polls at this point indicate that they might?
Yeah, well, if Republicans have a close to a clean sweep, you're going to see changes in the makeup of the Republican Senate conference. I think you hit the nail on the head, Ben. This is not going to be your father's Republican Party. It's going to be, you know, much more MAGA oriented. You know, it's going to be much more populist. I think where you may see some immediate changes, I shouldn't say changes, I think where the impact is going to be felt immediately is on foreign policy. And you have, if you do get Masters into that Senate caucus with J.D. Vance, who have taken, you know, field support, who has a very, very diametrically opposed view on Ukraine and other national security issues compared to Mitch McConnell and a lot of rank and file Republicans. And I think you'll see an immediate clash. You know, when it comes to funding for Ukraine, when it comes to the American view of national security, that is, Republicans, the traditional hawkish, just internationalist view is still going to be overwhelming within the caucus. But we're going to, you just said that it just takes two or three to really create a ruckus. And I mean, look, Lindsey, you know what I thought was interesting, Ben, is that Lindsey Graham was one of the big closers. He went down to Scottsdale for, you know, Blake Masters, which tells me that the politics are still very much in the kind of that mainstream wing of the party. But once these guys get elected, you know, they are kind of know where they stand. Yeah. And they're going to create some problems.
It's going to be fascinating to watch. And it comes at a real time, like I said before, of I just feel like this might be remembered as the first election where there was a noticeable generational shift, where we're kind of the old guard left. You know, you go from Jim Inhofe to someone like Mark Wayne Mullen, who obviously doesn't get anywhere near the kind of attention nationally as some of these other folks. That's a big shift. You know, you go from a guy who's been there forever to a guy who basically, you know, is like an ex, you know, MMA fighter, you know, and you're going to see some differences in the approach to how they do the job. Josh, thank you so much for taking the time to join me and to share your insight into this.
Thanks, Ben. Had a great time.
More of the Ben Domenech podcast right after this. So I just wanted to share with you a few thoughts in addition to the conversation that I just had with Josh about the midterms. It seems to me that one of the big things that's going to be a test coming out of this is setting the expectations for what voters can expect coming out of a Republican Congress in Washington versus the gubernatorial wins that Republicans might experience. On a state level, governors have far more power to influence policy, to direct the course of their state. They make major decisions about education, about individual issues and policies that are related to everything about our ways of life. And that's just not true of the Congress anymore. They have essentially been rendered defunct by a number of different steps that have been taken over the past several decades to devolve power away from them and into the bureaucracy. It's a terrible thing. It's empowered the administrative state, and it's led to a situation where the Congress really is not fulfilling its obligation to the people as it ought to be. However, that's not something that can be changed or turned around on a dime. And so instead, what can we expect to see? Well, we can expect to see oversight. We can expect to see steps from the Senate to block a number of Biden steps, particularly, nominees or any kind of major legislation that would spend a lot of your money. And we can also see it when it comes to the potential more aggressive stances toward this administration, one of which I think is of the utmost importance, which is impeaching Alexander Mayorkas over his work and lies regarding the border. Certainly, Mayorkas is someone who deserves it. I personally think that Democrats would actually be wise to let him spin and just abandon him to this. But that being set aside, what I think we need to keep in mind is that in the past, when major Republican waves have happened, you know, whether that was, in 1994 or in 2010, 2 years after that, you saw a situation where Republican voters were largely dissatisfied with what those Congresses had achieved. Even if they had had the kind of success, for instance, the Contract with America Congress did, or even if they had taken significant fiscal steps as the 2010 Tea Party had, you just did not see the kind of benefit that people would have liked to see when it came to, you know, being able to change policy in significant ways. This is unfortunate, but it's just the way that the system works now. And I think that it's, incumbent upon us to demand that Congress take back a lot of its power from the bureaucracy, from the administrative state, in order to actually start representing our interests. That being said, I think that what we can hope for is that this is a Congress that is going to be quite aggressive. They've been treated very badly while being in the minority by Nancy Pelosi and her leadership team on the House side. And I think on the Senate side, you're going to have a series of people, eight or nine people, in fact, show up who all want to make a dramatic difference and impact on that chamber in ways that are often, I think, going to be irritating to the existing powers that be and to Mitch McConnell's team, but also that I think they would be wise to enable as opposed to block. This is a Senate and a House that wants to be very aggressive in stopping what they believe to be very bad policies from this Biden administration. And the more that they lean into that and choose the right battles, the more that I think they can accomplish significant things. The important thing is to not be distracted by shiny objects, by the appeal of steps that are ultimately not going to result in any kind of benefit for the American people. And of course, all of this is going to be happening in all likelihood in the context of a 2024 campaign that begins the day after this November's election. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.